March 14th, 2016, and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration, a conversation about migration and politics at the University of Amsterdam. I'm Dushan Vigneshwaran, and today we discuss the new deal between the EU and Turkey on the so-called refugee crisis. On the 7th of March, Turkey offered to take back all migrants entering the EU from Turkey who didn't have the right to enter or the right to claim protection. For every migrant that Turkey receives, the EU has offered to resettle one Syrian refugee currently residing in Turkey. Today, speaking through an audio feed, Frank Devel is going to offer his thoughts on these new developments. Hi, Frank. Thanks for joining us.
Morning.
Now, Frank's an associate professor and senior researcher at Compass, a research centre in Oxford, and he's currently working on a project called Unravelling the Mediterranean Migration Crisis, which, from the looks of some of your blog posts, Frank, has you on the road a lot?
I've been travelling the region for a couple of months last year, and had ever since been following developments in particular in the Eastern Mediterranean, in the Aegean Sea. So everything to do with Turkey, Greece, Macedonia, I'm well aware of. And I have visited all the sites myself, Izmir, Istanbul, Lesbos, Athens, Piraeus, and then Idomeni on the Greek-Macedonian border.
Fantastic. Well, you're exactly the person we need to speak to then. Now, to outsiders, this deal may seem like a fair trade. We take one of yours and you take one of ours. In Brussels speak, the EU-Turkey deal is burden-sharing par excellence. But your previous work has questioned this type of rhetoric, saying the EU external migration policy is more geared towards burden-shifting than burden-sharing. So, in your thoughts, what are we to make of this new deal?
Well, the deal very much looks indeed like a burden shifting, a responsibility shifting from the EU to Turkey. Turkey, by becoming an immigration country, is basically normalizing, because all other affluent industrialized countries attract immigrants. Turkey is now attracting immigrants in a globalizing world. I would say Turkey is on the path of normalization, and receiving immigrants, including refugees, is normal. But the political decisions made on the two ends are, the EU is clearly saying, we do not want refugees, we certainly do not want any more refugees, and Turkey hasn't made up its mind whether or not it accepts becoming an immigration country. And the people we talk about, the migrants and refugees, are somewhat sandwiched between these two political positions.
Right. So the rhetoric that we hear in terms of representing this as if Europeans are willing to take on their share of the refugee burden. They just don't really want it to come in an irregular fashion. They don't want people to come through irregular channels. You would dispute that sort of representation?
I suppose almost all individual EU member states have made clear over the course of last year, when we discussed relocation and resettlement of refugees from Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and Greece, that they don't want to admit refugees from other parts of the world, and not even from Greece. It's become absolutely crystal clear, the EU member states do not actually want refugees. In that light, I do not quite see how you could make the current arrangement, the deal as it is called, work by turning people back to Turkey and admitting the same number of people to the EU, when all EU member states have said either we've already got enough, like Germany and Finland and Sweden, sorry, or have said we actually don't want to resettle anybody.
Yeah, I mean, we're already seeing some signs that the scenes of consensus in Brussels have broken apart. I mean, this morning we had, I think it was the Austrian foreign minister questioning the so-called deal and saying that, you know, they're not going to support it. We've got many voices within Germany. What What do you think are the chances of it ultimately being ratified, given this, you know, clear fracturing that we're seeing already?
I can't really see any credible signs so far that the EU is actually resettling a significant number, which means several hundred thousand people from Turkey to the EU. And in terms of an implementation of such an agreement, there is simply no structure, no infrastructure, no legal framework, no protocol in place. This is not to be covered by the Greek Turkey or by the EU Turkey readmission agreement, which is not geared up for such large numbers of people. And it's not geared up for the very technical questions. How physically you take people from the Greek islands and from Greece to Turkey? By ferry, by boat, by aeroplane? Which border crossing point will be used? Will there be staff to deal with the paperwork? On which grounds will people be sent back? On which grounds will people be accepted by Turkey? Once they are on Turkish shore, what to do then? Refugee reception center, they don't exist. Refugee detention centers, they are all full. So it is an idea, but there is no system, structure, apparatus in place yet that could introduce such a system. And on the other side, the one-to-one suggestion, one is sent back, one is resettled. How are these people who are going to be resettled selected? On which grounds are they selected? Who selects them? How will they then get from Turkey to the EU? Will they be taken by aeroplane? Will they be taken by bus? Will there be border crossing points opened? Who is checking the paperwork on both ends? I don't see the administration in place yet that could deal with such a large scale. Well, it's almost like an exchange of populations, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that in the sort of radical simplicity of this deal as it's been presented to us, we're missing all of these legal and logistical challenges that I'm sure there are certain bureaucrats in Brussels who are trying to think through now and just simply don't have the tools to do, as you've set out for us. And one of the things that I think as well is a key assumption behind the whole deal is that Turkey is merely a country of transit. And you've mentioned this before, that, you know, the migration profile of Turkey is changing as we speak. But there's this idea that it's a place that migrants just simply want to move through in order to get where they really want to live, settle and put down roots, which is in Europe. But I think in a lot of your research on transit migration, you've questioned this assumption. And could you provide us some of the logic behind that?
Well, we can clearly see, as I've said, that Turkey has been becoming an immigration country, but Turkey hasn't really prepared the ground for becoming an immigration country, which would mean, and this is most relevant in the case of refugees, in particular from Syria, to provide them with a stable, more permanent immigration status that also signals to them that they could settle down and put down roots. Syrians are kept under a temporary protection regime, and the emphasis lies on temporariness. They are signaled that this is only for a limited period of time. So far, Syrians have also not been given permission to legally work in Turkey and thereby make a living. So the two main conditions that you would want to see as a refugee, whether or not you can stay, whether or not you can work and make a living, are not met. And this has been contributing to driving people out of the country towards the European Union. And the third point is that Turkey has been fairly generous to provide camp accommodation to the first wave of arrivals, 250,000. But all other 2.3 million are not provided with any accommodation. Turkey has also provided access to certain social services, in particular healthcare and education. But this is barely implemented because the resources are not there to provide Syrians and other refugees with services. They've got these rights on paper, but these rights cannot be realized because of a lack of staff, nurses, teachers, translators, and all the rest of it. With the help of the EU sending 3 billion plus another 3 billion, Turkey might be in a better position to actually implement these rights that so far mostly exist on paper. But again, how long does it take to recruit thousands of Arab-speaking teachers, of Arab-speaking nurses? You don't only recruit them, you need to train them, you need to have them. There might be lots of Syrians knowing these professions, but they need to learn the language. So whatever the decision is, will only impact after a considerable time lapse. And the EU and Turkey both have lost very valuable time, basically over 4 years since the beginning of the conflict in Syria, to think about these issues and to prepare for an appropriate response. We basically start from scratch, have lost these 4 years.
So Frank, you provide us a really skeptical view of the deal and its prospects of successful implementation, some of the assumptions upon it, which it's based. I want you to think a little bit, let's now consider a scenario in which it was to work and what, you know, people like Prime Minister Cameron are proclaiming as shutting off the Balkan route actually happens. What would be the long-term implications of such an achievement in the EU's eyes for migrants themselves and the people who are trying to utilize the existing routes?
It is indeed to some extent possible to close the Balkan route and even the Aegean sea crossing route to a significant extent. There will be always people who are desperate enough, confident enough, and to have the resources to continue traveling clandestinely. The numbers I would predict will be going down significantly. Initially, this would mean that the people of concern, the refugees from Syria and Iraq, Afghanistan, they bear the brunt. They will be left in limbo. They will find themselves in countries like Turkey, to some extent also Greece, which are neither ready nor prepared nor have the resources to meet the needs of these people. It will inevitably increase the suffering of the people. Another implication is that the EU is de facto again closing its borders to people in need of protection. There is no more access to protection in the European Union. And another implication that's also been discussed by international organizations is that the International Geneva Refugee Convention has de facto been suspended. Many of the provisions of the Geneva Refugee Convention have been suspended. Access to protection has been suspended. Non-refoulement, meaning not sending people back to a country where they cannot get asylum, has been abandoned. And we should not forget in this context Turkey is a country which puts a reservation on the Geneva Refugee Convention, saying literally that no non-European person can be granted a refugee status in Turkey. So the people who are sent back to Turkey have no access to a full refugee status in Turkey. Therefore, Turkey cannot be considered a safe country under the conditions of EU and international law. And by sending people back to a country where they cannot get asylum, is de facto a suspension of the Geneva Refugee Convention. So there is a whole range of implications. And at the end of the day, I wonder also what the impact on the EU's reputation abroad in the world will be. To what extent will this undermine the soft powers of the EU? The EU basically only has soft powers, and the soft powers rest on the notion of democracy, human rights, rule of law, fairness, which is basically jeopardized by the current policy response, and in particular by this deal. How is the EU going to educate other countries on human rights, refugee rights, women's rights and children's rights if the EU is in the same time violating all these rights?
Frank, that's a really dire reading. We're seeing, in your words, I guess, the end of the UN Refugee Convention in Europe, and also some significant watering down of any moral authority that European Union might have had. If I could get just your thoughts on one more issue before we go. Another important development during the meeting last Monday was the involvement of NATO. Turkish Prime Minister Davutoğlu also met with NATO's Secretary General Stoltenberg, and afterwards Stoltenberg announced that NATO would commence operations in Greek and Turkish territorial waters to, in his words, locate the migrants. Is this sort of move going to solve anything?
I've got two major concerns here. One is normative, legal, the other one is practical. I can't see in NATO's agreement and mandate that it is meant to address anything but security issues between states. NATO is de facto a military defense organization set up for the protection of its member states from external threats from other state actors. NATO has never been set up to deal with people's movements, migration, refugees, humanitarian crises, and is going well beyond its mandate. This is the one point. The other point is NATO brings together militaries, armies and navies. These are equipped, these are made, equipped and the staff trained to engage in military action, in using weapons. They are not meant and not equipped and not trained for rescuing people. The boats are simply too high. The staff knows how to man a cannon, but not to help a person in distress, suffering from hypothermia, or traumatized. This is simply not their job and their training. I cannot see how they would be able to provide an appropriate response to a humanitarian crisis, to people in maritime distress, in need of being rescued or cared for. This has always been the mandate of civilian rescue structures and not of the army. The army is the wrong organization in the wrong place here.
I'm pretty sure a lot of NATO commanders would probably agree with you, Frank. Thanks so much for your thoughts. They've been really insightful for us and I'm sure for our audience. For those of you who are interested in finding out more about Frank's research, you can go to his staff page at www.compass.ox.ac.uk or check out his blog, Essays on Migration and Politics, at fduvell.tumblr.com. Monday Morning Meetings on Migration is run by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. The podcast can be accessed from our blog at 4mpodcast.com, and you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. You can also sign up for our updates on Twitter and Facebook. And if you have suggestions about a story you'd like us to feature, or would like to post an audio rejoinder to something that has been said on a previous podcast, please send us an email at imes@uva.nl.